Hello and welcome to the Celeste Stein Show. I'm your host, Dr. Celeste Stein, and I invite you to like, share, and subscribe to my channels on bbsradio.com and YouTube. We certainly appreciate it. Now, today, we're going to be speaking with a woman who is an absolute trailblazer in journalism. Wanda Lloyd has been a writer and editor, columnist, and author. She has also worked for the Washington Post, the Providence Evening Bulletin, the Miami Herald, the Atlanta Journal, and many, many more. She is well known for years of service and many, many accolades, including the National Association of Black Journalists Region 3 Hall of Fame Award. And let's not forget, she is also one of my dearly beloved Spelman sisters, where we both attended college in Atlanta, Georgia. Wanda, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes, I'm so glad you're here. I actually wanted to kind of take you back to the beginning of your journalism career to ask when you knew you had an inkling that you might have a gift for writing.
Well, I actually knew in high school. I took a journalism class in the 11th grade. I took a class in journalism just sort of as a sort of a diversion from all those, tough science and math college prep courses. But I found that I really loved it. And at the end of the 11th grade, my journalism teacher asked me to be the editor of the newspaper the next year, the school newspaper. And that's when I decided that I really wanted this to be my life's work.
Yeah, that's kind of how I got started in really speaking and public speaking. And thank God for teachers who recognize things in our, that we find that later we might have a gift for in ourselves that maybe we don't quite know at the time. But I had a French teacher that encouraged me to be a part of the first forensics team at my high school. And with that, we ended up going all the way like to the state championship. So, it's really amazing to hear how those early roots take place with us, in terms of what we end up doing for a career and what an amazing career you've had. I wanted to ask, so you started in high school, realized you had a gift. When did you actually start writing professionally in the news business?
Well, I went to Spelman, which of course has no journalism classes. And so I had to find a way into the newspaper business. And I took some journalism classes in the very beginning of the program at what was then called Clark College, which, as you know, is just across the street from Spelman. And in the another teacher, another a professor, my journalism professor suggested that I apply for an internship with the Dow Jones Newspaper Fund, which has changed its name now. And he really coached me on copy editing because I knew what it was like to be a reporter. I had been a reporter in high school. I'd been a reporter for the Spelman Spotlight, the newspaper at Spelman, but I didn't really know what a copy editor did. So I thought, why don't I apply for that? I got an internship. I believe I was in the very first year that they admitted some African Americans in the program. And I was assigned to the Providence Evening Bulletin. So that was my first professional job between my junior and senior year in college. And then at the end of that summer, the managing editor offered me the opportunity to come back to Providence after I graduated. So a year later, I found myself back in Providence, Rhode Island.
Wow. We have to go back and speak to our Spelman folks. I know you've been on the board of trustees there, and we need to talk to them about getting something going with journalism because we have a lot of folks that have definitely gone into the field. I too had to take those classes at Clark College, and I remember I was actually there when they were building the Robert R. Woodruff Library. Where they had the radio station and the TV station WCLK, and so that's kind of how I got my early start in radio working there. But I was in the old building and had a 2-hour morning entertainment show where I used to interview politicians and celebrities, and just remember that as such a wonderful experience. But yeah, I was kind of there when Spike Lee was in school in
Oh
middle
yeah.
ed.
So Celeste, I have to say that when I came back to Spelman after that summer of internship, I was editor of the paper the senior year. So I got my student media experience as an editor, had been an editor in high school and in college. So it's, you're right, Spelman has not recognized journalism. I'm not sure they ever will, because they really are so heavily involved in the sciences, as you know. But a lot of students, because of the strong emphasis on languages and English and writing at Spelman, I think that's one reason many of us are successful in various media careers.
Right. Yeah, I remember some of the greats like Dr. Deborah Hewitt, who she actually encouraged me to get the master's in journalism at Northwestern, and mentored me strongly there. But great, great teachers, and that definitely helps with the foundation. And I've forgotten all about that Spelman Spotlight, but I also worked, I wasn't the editor now, but I wrote a few articles.
Right. Yeah.
Remember that. But I wanted to also ask you, so at the time you got started in your career, you know, especially in those early days, I know there were definitely not a lot of women or minorities working in American newsrooms. There started to be a push, but I really wanted to ask you, what was that like? Because I don't think a lot of people often hear that story from us who, you know, back in the early days when it was like all men, you know, and right. You're wondering, you know, what was that like for you?
Well, it was all white men, quite frankly, especially in a place like Providence, Rhode Island. There was only one other African-American professional in the building, and she worked in classified advertising department at the time that I was there. So it was interesting because I had gone to an all-Black school, segregated school. I had gone to Spelman, which, of course, the student body was 99.9% Black. Many of our professors.
Yeah. Huh? I said, and women.
And women. Yes, a lot of women. And many of our professors were white, but except for that experience at Spelman, I had never really been around white people because I grew up in the what we call the Jim Crow era, when we didn't really interact with people who were not in our own community. And so it was interesting. I think the thing that I focused on the most was just the professionalism. That's what helped me to survive. And I spent another 2 years in Providence before I was invited to go to another newspaper, the Miami Herald, which was totally different because at Miami, they had hired at the time I was there, they were hiring quite a few African Americans. And so that was the first time I felt like I had a family of people who I could communicate with and understood some of the things that I was interested in. So early on, it was quite lonely until I got to Miami. It was not the best situation in Miami because even in those early days, they didn't quite know what to do with us. They were not giving us the best assignments. They were not positioning Black reporters. I was a copy editor at the time, but they were not positioning Black reporters to do some of the high profile stories. And many of us were young. We admit that. And those high profile stories are what get you recognized, get you promoted, get you bigger assignments, get you, you know, to move on to bigger and better newspapers or media organizations. So that's what it was kind of like in the early days.
Yeah, I can remember, you know, my first job out of Northwestern, we actually got to work as correspondents on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C.
And right, I'm very familiar with that program. That's a wonderful, wonderful program.
Yeah, the Medill School, I tell you, anybody listening, you know. Right. Definitely, you know, wanted to go to one of the top schools, but I can remember some of those experiences and being in Lynchburg, Virginia. You know, they say you kind of need to start in the small market. Lynchburg's like market size, I think 68 or so at the time. So that's not a bad market to kind of get started in. But
yeah, I have actually been to Lynchburg. One of my best friends from high school still lives there. She's an attorney in Lynchburg.
Yes, yes. I have, you know, obviously I love my Lynchburg people and have, you know, a lot of friends that are still there and, you know, get to go back, you know, from time to time as I head up to Washington, D.C. I peep my head in and say hello or go by and visit the old TV station. But I just, you know, I can remember covering so many interesting stories out of there. So, you know, in Lynchburg was where Dr. Jerry Falwell was,
Right.
and the old time gospel hour was right next door to the TV station. So I was there when it was like the whole Jim and Tammy Faye Baker story. And so I had many stories, you know, aired nationally on ABC with Peter Jennings. You know, they pick up those stories from your affiliate stations that, you know, when it was something going on like that. But I also can remember I've interviewed David Duke, head of the Ku Klux Klan. You know, actually covered. I can remember this one time, sitting in the newsroom. There were about three of us in there, and the assignments editor, that's a person, you know, for the listeners that may not know, you know, they assign all the stories in the TV station. They kind of write everything on a board as far as what's going on for the day. So he looks at there are three of us in there, another African American woman, who's a dear friend of mine, and this guy, you know, all of us reporters and anchors, and the assignments editor looks over at us and says, "Well, I think we can do a tag team where you guys can cover this Klan rally, you know, through the streets of Lynchburg." And I'm sitting there going, you know, I'm just sink letting it all sink in, you know, just, you know, I'm kind of looking. And then my friend Lisa, she says, she's like about 5'11, almost 6 feet. And she kind of towered over the assignments editor, and she's standing over him saying, "Are you sure you want me to cover this story?" And I said to myself, you know, so tell us more. What about this tag team? So anyway, you know, I was at the head of the parade, and my friend Lisa was actually at City Hall, and the other guy Danny was sort of in the middle, and so the City Hall was all the way at the end. And so learned so many interesting things from that story about, you know, permits and making sure you have a legal permit to actually, you know, be able to march and have a parade. But that was a shocker, because I had no idea what to expect. It was,
Right.
in a way, kind of scary to, you know, be involved in something where there could be violence or what have you. And indeed there was, because at I was very surprised, though. The people in the community actually came out, and they had rocks and sticks, seriously, and started throwing them at the people in the parade. And they were just, you know, very offended. They were like, you know, we work so hard, you know, obviously the name of the town is Lynchburg, to get away from the stigma and all these things, and they just really were not wanting to tolerate that. And
Yeah.
so that was surprising. You know, that was really surprising to me. So, you know, I learned something that day, and even with fear and not being afraid to learn to cover
Yeah.
things and
You
such.
know, I was my last newsroom was the Montgomery Advertiser in Alabama. And we had a we and there were lots of Klan rallies in Montgomery, especially around the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is based in Montgomery. The Southern Poverty Law Center deals with issues, I'll just say very briefly, was it hate and tolerance? So, you know, the difference between it's really conservative and liberal, but it's a very liberal organization. And one Saturday there was going to be a Klan rally, and I was the executive editor of the paper, so my job was to be sure that our staff had it covered. And we had a rotation of Saturday reporters, and the Saturday main Saturday general assignment reporter happened to be an African American male who has since won a Pulitzer Prize, I might add, at another news organization. So I said, okay, well, you're going to cover this Klan rally. There's no reason to change your assignment. And he did. And on Saturday, I came into the office Saturday afternoon just to see how things were going. And he told me that he and all the TV reporters from each TV station who were assigned happened to be African American on that day. And the Klan was in front of SPLC standing there doing their rally. And I guess they looked up at the bank of reporters and went, "Oh my God, what happened here? How did all the reporters turn out to be African American?" We didn't have any violence, but that's sort of the evolution, because this would have been in, like, I don't know, 2010 or something like that. It was fairly recent because that was my last newsroom assignment. So those things go on all the time, and we have to adapt. You know, we have to learn how to cover everything. And you know, journalism to me is sort of like a business. And you talked about learning to get the permits and positioning yourself in the right place. So that's a large part of what an editor's job is, and that's kind of what I did.
Right. Yeah. You know, and I know you worked a lot behind the scenes. I actually wanted to ask something that I don't hear a lot of people get asked, and that is, did you ever have to deal with any instances of like direct racism in the newsroom or the communities that you serve?
The better question would have been, did I work at a newspaper where I didn't have to deal with that? Okay. So the answer is obviously yes. I guess the only exception would have been in Providence, where I had no issues with racism. I had more issues, I think, with sexism, especially from some of the women who not, there wasn't they weren't sexist, but they were dictationists, and they didn't understand how I was a professional. They didn't know where I came from, basically. They really literally asked me, where did you come from? But they were taking dictation from the reporters who were calling in their stories back in the day. That's how people called in their stories. But yes, absolutely. At several papers, I dealt with the issue of having of trying to make sure that the paper was equally was balanced with coverage, diversity, as we call used to call it, now it's DEI. And there was a lot of pushback from readers, some from inside the newsroom. We had metrics. We had a plan to be sure that our reporters understood the whole community and were calling sources who were people of color and women and old and young. You know, we didn't want just middle-aged white men to be the sources in our stories. And I happened to walk by a young lady at one in one newsroom who was calling someone looking for a black person to interview, but the way she put it was, my editor says I have to get a black person for this story. And so, of course, I called her into my office after that phone call, and I, you know, and we had a conversation about why it's important to have diversity. I've had many people question why I was there in terms of internally, but externally, I think I had more pushback from readers who said, in some cases, this is no longer my newspaper. And clearly the message was, y'all used to cover white people. All I saw was white people on the front page. And or I used to see black people on the front, young black men on the front page, but they were all, you know, in somehow involved with crime. They were charged or they were at large. And so at a couple of papers, I instituted a rule that says we will no longer run mugshots on the front page, because that is something that sends a strong message to people. It's a stereotype, and it sends a strong message that because, and statistically, I talked to the police in both communities, statistically, more young black men were being arrested than others. That doesn't mean they were guilty. That means they were arrested. And so they would gladly provide the mugshots to the newspaper. And our editors were running it on the front page all the time. And so when we banned that, I said, we're no longer running mugshots of anybody, black, white, yellow, whatever their color, male or female. And a few times editors would push back because they weren't used to doing that. But it did sort of change the dynamic with readers who came to expect that they would get those mugshots. The only exception was if we ran a picture on page one, it was because someone was at large and a danger to society. Because you know, you want to know what they look like if they're out there, you know, allegedly
Sure.
crimes.
Well, one of the things I remember when I was in Nashville working for the ABC affiliate there, you used to hear things come across on the police scanner,
Yes.
and we often will report it how it came to us on the police scanner. And we started to notice that when they described a person of color, they basically were describing like over half the population, what you said, male, black, 20s, wearing a hoodie. I'm like, I was like, what is the point of that? So, I mean, we had conversations about things like that, and we were like, unless you have something that can actually describe them in better detail, like a tattoo or
A mole in the top of their head or something that's very distinctive.
right.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah. So it's funny how as those things come up, how they are handled, and I think that is good to have that diversity to address that. And that's across the board in terms of being
And you know, I
aware.
worked with USA Today for 10 years. I was managing editor and senior editor at USA Today. And we had a rule, and this was in the 80s and 90s. And we had a rule that, an editorial policy, I should say, that there would be the image of a black, a person of color and a woman on page one above the fold every day. In a story that's not a negative portrayal. There could be a negative story somewhere on the page, but it had to be some representation of something positive. It could be a sports story, it could be a business story, it could be a news story. But that was kind of the beginning of a lot of newspapers really looking at how do we cover our community? How do we show what our community looks like in all its forms, good and bad?
Right. I can remember too. One thing that's really important when it comes to covering different communities, you can't be afraid to cover those communities. And I have found that some of my counterparts, even at Northwestern, would say things like they'd never been around anyone of color. I mean, from wherever they may have grown up, and that's not their fault, but our professors would certainly say, well, how do you expect to get the story if you can't talk to someone or you don't feel comfortable or you don't even understand the culture or where these folks are coming from? You're not going to get a very good story. So I think it takes some time, it takes learning, it actually takes getting into communities and getting to know people, but
One of
also
my solutions
having.
for that in one of my newsrooms, one of my solutions for that is I rented a bus and I got an African American historian to take us on a tour of the Black community because I wanted our entire staff, and we may have done like two bus tours. I wanted the staff to understand that there are some rich stories in this traditionally Black community. This is a working class community for sure, but there were also professionals there. There were teachers and preachers and lawyers and who remained in the Black community, and they were working hard to be sure that their children had access to all the necessary things, a good education, preparation for a good job, starting businesses. We all wanted the same things in the community. But there, you're right, there were people who had never been to that community unless there was some element of crime. And you're right, they were afraid to talk to people. They were afraid to walk up to people, but it helped them understand that there are some good sources for positive stories, business stories, for example, because African Americans in those Black communities all over the country have small businesses. You know, they're opening up their own pharmacies and their little grocery stores and lots of things like that. And now it's way beyond African American. It's all people, especially people of color.
And talk about breaking down some stereotypes, because I think sometimes people, if all you know is what you maybe see on television or in the movies, you're not getting nearly what you should be if you plan to be a journalist. You have got to understand, like you just said, there are minority businesses and there are many good people, just like with anything, there are good and bad people with everything. And so you can't be afraid to, get to know people and really understand those communities so that those stories can be told. One thing I want to do is take a quick break. When we come back, we will be chatting more with Wanda Lloyd about her work as a journalist and editor and some of her writing projects. We'll be back right after this.
A lot of things have come to a screeching halt due to COVID-19, but you should know that the court system in Tennessee is still open and holding in-person hearings for orders of protection and other types of abuse cases. If you have a hearing date, double-check on where your hearing will be held. If you need assistance on an order of protection or temporary restraining order, contact the Legal Aid Society at 1-800-238-1443 or visit our website at www.las.org.
And welcome back to the Celeste Stein Show. I'm your host, Dr. Celeste Stein, and we are speaking with Wanda Lloyd, author of Coming Full Circle, From Jim Crow to Journalism. Now, we have been having a wonderful conversation today about your many years as a journalist. I wanted to ask you, on behalf of young people who might be thinking of becoming journalists, what advice would you give them?
Well, the landscape has changed a lot. Traditional media, like you and I were a part of, has changed so much. And so, first, young people need to understand what journalism is or what journalism is not. It's not just starting, that may be more important. It's not just starting your own blog without any training. There's a foundation that needs to happen before you call yourself a journalist, whether you become a traditional journalist or with some of the newer platforms like podcasting and digital platforms. So the first is to be a good to learn how to write well, learn grammar, and to read a lot of news and information. That was my foundation. That's why my high school journalism teacher realized that I had what it takes to be the editor because I was a well-read person. I knew a lot of stuff. And when I became a copy editor, one of my friends who is not a journalist said, "You know a lot of trivia, don't you?" And so learning a lot of trivia is very important. That means to be to dedicate yourself to reading a lot, to listening a lot, to watching news, traditional news and not non-traditional news. The second these days, quite frankly, is to be comfortable with technology, which I think a lot of young people are, but you have to learn technology in the right way. I have a podcast. I've been a podcaster, but I cannot touch the technology. I don't, I know enough to sign on and to sit here and talk, but I'm not the person who produces. So learning about things behind the scene is important because it's not just the people you see on television or whose bylines you see on digital platforms, but there are a whole lot of jobs and careers behind the scenes that are just as important as being the person whose name is across the screen or on the page or on the digital platform. So those would be some of the things. Just learn a lot. And finally, I would say learn about civics. They're not teaching civics the way they used to teach civics. I'm finding out, at least in Savannah, Georgia, where I live, we work through some organizations that I belong to. We work with a lot of young people who really don't understand things like why do you have to vote? And if you do vote, how do you figure out who you should vote for or what referendum you need to support? So become and learn about civics. And if you're not learning it in school, there are other ways, going to the library, going online, reading about who's running and what they're going to their platform, but also what those positions do. If you have a city council or a county commission, understand the difference between city government and county government. Understand the people that are involved. So those would be some of the things that I would suggest.
Yeah, awesome. Well, I know some people say, news is a very tough business. And I can remember as a young person telling my dad, who was very stern, very strict, I wanted to be a journalist. And he was like, oh, he was like, I don't think so. It's so competitive. And, maybe you might want to think about being a doctor or something like that, And
Can
I
I
just
say that my grandmother, when I announced to my family that journalism was going to be my life's work, my grandmother, in her very southern drawl, said something like, "Well, Wanda, I don't think I ever knew a color any colored girls who worked for a newspaper before." And then she told me to take some education classes because I needed something to fall back on. And I knew that I didn't want to be a teacher and I wanted to be a journalist. And I didn't take any education courses. I kind of regret that now because I worked at four universities over the course of my career, sometimes while I was working in a newsroom. So that her advice was good, but she discouraged me. She didn't, like your father, she didn't understand how we could do the job that they expected us to do. Because nobody else, they didn't know anybody who had done it before us.
I think I'm very fortunate to have grown up in Washington, D.C., and I had some wonderful role models on television to watch, Connie Chung and Carol Simpson and Renee Poussaint, people like that, that were some of the greats, and just a lot of people that I admired, certainly as journalists, but Did you find it when you got into it to be competitive, or did you just kind of block all that out? How did you kind of handle that part of it?
Well, there were no mentors and no role models for me. So you came along in a different generation, a younger generation. I never saw anyone who looked like me on television. No women, no people of color in my community or on national shows. They didn't exist. I never saw any bylines by women, except maybe on the features page, stories about, I don't know, society balls or something like that would have been. We read the Savannah papers, morning and evening, and the Atlanta papers, as well as some black newspapers when I was growing up. But in terms of your question about competitiveness, I had the opposite. So the American Society of Newspaper Editors didn't start counting or measuring diversity in newsrooms until 1978. I got into the business in 1970, so they weren't even measuring. But you can bet that the numbers were fewer than in 78. But in 78, 4.5% of the population of newsrooms, of newspapers, we were not counting broadcast, were four. It was 4.5%. That's very, very low. And so when, for those newsrooms that wanted diversity, that wanted to see women and perhaps people of color, they were clamoring for people who were trained, and there weren't many of us. Therefore, I did not have a hard time getting jobs. In fact, it was sort of the opposite. I had to kind of slow myself down and say, wait a minute, you need to stay here 2 years. You need to stay here 2 years, because I could have moved very quickly. One year after I was in Providence, I ended up for the summer in the summer pro as a faculty member in the summer program for minority journalists at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. I was teaching, and I was editor of the student newspaper that summer. So it was not a challenge when I got the call from Bob Maynard, who was the director of the program. He said, as far as I can tell, you're one of two African American, well, he said black at the time, black copy editors in the entire country working for a stream newspaper.
That's sinking.
And let that sink in. And the other person, and he gave me his name, I don't remember his name, was at the Atlanta paper at the time. And I think he had a family. He didn't want to come to New York for the summer, for the 12-week program. And so I got the job. I was 22 years old. I was the youngest person in the class. And the students were older, not a whole lot older, but the students were older than I was, because it was a program to teach second career people. So the competition was not very stiff at the beginning. When I left Providence, I went to Miami because I got a call from someone who from the what was in the Knight Company looking for a copy editor. I said, I've been in Providence for 2 years. I'm very cold. Where's your warmest newspaper? And they said that would be the Miami Herald. So that's how I ended up in Miami. So I left Miami, came back to Atlanta, worked for the Journal for 6 months, ended up getting engaged to someone I met in Providence, Rhode Island, and a few years before. So I ended up in Washington at the Washington Post for 11 years. The Washington Post had called me at least 3 times between my Providence and my Miami stint, asking me to come in an interview. And I said I really didn't want to come to Washington as a single woman. I wanted to, because I had heard that there were four women to every single man. And remember, this was right after the Vietnam War, when a lot of black men had been drafted and didn't go to college or died. I mean, they didn't have. Anyway, the pool was very small. So I became engaged to someone. That's how I ended up in Washington and then USA Today, because of a contact that I had from Miami. The person who was the managing editor in Miami hired me in at USA Today. So and then it went on from there. I worked at seven daily newspapers and ended up in Nashville for a while
Oh, I didn't
as
realize
the
you were
founding.
with Gannett or where in Nashville.
In Nashville, I worked for the Freedom Forum for
Freedom
5 years.
Forum. Oh, okay, with John Siegenthaler.
I stepped out of the newsroom for a while, and I was the founding executive director of the Diversity Institute at Vanderbilt University. So we built a building and built a program and trained non-traditional people for newsroom careers, trying to bring those numbers up. Remember that 4.5%? The numbers climbed very slowly. And I don't think when I got out of the business, we were still at like 11%. And the population of people of color was, I don't know, 25, somewhere between 25 and 30% at that time. And so, so we started a program very similar to the Columbia program, which no longer existed.
Mm-hmm. Now, was that the boot camp, or is that what you're talking about?
No, it wasn't a boot camp. It was a 12-week immersive program at Vanderbilt.
Okay.
That taught journalism to non-traditional students of color, all people of color.
Well, I have not heard about that one. I know I participated in the boot camp program with Val Heppner. Mm-hmm. That was really good to teach about all these new media technologies. I mean, what a wonderful program. That's where I learned about, you know, a lot of the new digital mediums and, you know, mm-hmm. using the SD cards and
we didn't even have digital media when we were
at
teaching.
That time.
This started, I went there in 2001 through 2004, I guess. And we were teaching very traditional journalism, but we were teaching people who were late 20s to 60s, who mm-hmm. were leaving another career and had a talent for writing or editing, or we had a couple of photographers, a graphic artist we trained. And so we were looking all over the country for newspapers to partner with us to find people in their community to send to us. And we paid 100% of the cost of that program, the Freedom Fund.
Amazing. Is that still going on?
No longer there. The building is still there. And in fact, I the first month that my memoir was out, I was there back at the Diversity Institute to talk about my book, but the program is no longer there. The newspaper industry could not support it after 2008 and the recession.
Right. Yeah, I know I pulled a lot of statistics when I was working on my PhD for my dissertation, because I did it on the future of the newsroom in the age of new media. And it was something like 10,000 papers had closed since all this new media technology has come about. And it's just really interesting to kind of see where things are headed. Well, now that we have all these different mediums and ways in which we might get information, and people want it in little snippets and bits, and, you know, I am seeing so many things that I have never seen before with journalists, you know, doing things like dancing on set and, you know, just anything to get the number of likes up and that type of thing. And I'm just really often in amazement when I see things like this that just were not a part of the landscape when I was a journalist working, you know, day in and day out doing that. So what are your thoughts about that when you see those type of things? Do you take them serious as journalists?
Because I'm old school and because I'm a traditional journalist, it's difficult for me to take some of them serious. But I am on, you know, several of the social media platforms. I get my news that way. You know, I subscribe to several paid subscription to several daily news organizations, the traditional ones like the Washington Post and the New York Times, the Atlanta Journal, and of course my local paper, as well as some non-traditional ones. I want to see what some of the young folks are doing. I enjoy that. Yeah. You know, yeah, right. The National Association of Black Journalists, for example, has a news website now. And so I subscribe to that. So a lot of the newsletters have news in them. I subscribe to some of those things. I listen to blogs podcasts, news podcasts, all the time, whether it's NPR and some of the traditional companies or some individual people, because I do want to know what people are doing, but I don't tolerate those people who just wake up one morning and say, I'm a journalist. I don't tolerate that. Yeah, I don't want to hear that.
Tell me about that. Yeah. You know, it's so interesting with the new media technologies. I know that it seems like, you know, one might get left behind. That's kind of was my take on things. If you cannot adapt, you know, so the constant here is actually change. You know, there's so much information, and the only way we can kind of keep up with the hamster wheel is by actually learning some of these technologies to be able to keep up with the 24-hour news cycle. Because when I was coming up, it was your four basic channels. You had ABC, NBC, CBS, and maybe the
And you
Fox.
programmed yourself to sit down at 6 o'clock and listen to the news. Now you got
Right.
news all day, all night, all the time.
Yeah, that 24-hour thing. And so how news is gathered and disseminated has obviously changed as a result of that faster pace news cycle. So when you think about all of the new media technologies, I know it's helped in many ways, but as we kind of look forward to things like AI and how that's going to impact the business, what are you thinking, or what do you kind of see, since you've been at this such a long time, that we're going to see going forward in terms of our future with AI?
Well, we can never, I can never predict what the future is going to be. When I first started hearing about AI, I was very much opposed to it. USA Today, I think it was, yeah, it was USA Today. They ran a story, I think it was a sports story, and they used AI to cover the story. And they found that some of the facts were wrong. And so they had to then not only correct or apologize for using that story, but they pulled back at the time. I don't know if they've changed now. They pulled back, and this was like a year ago, not that long ago, but they pulled back and said, we're not going to use AI for our stories because we've got to wait until we can figure out how to do it the right way, so that because they want to be accurate all the time. So we're sort of in the time where this it's evolving and we're having to learn about it. And sometimes I'll tune into an online show or a podcast about AI because I just want to keep up with it. However, I'm finding that I'm using AI a little bit, not for writing, but for giving me ideas. I love the bullet points that come from AI. For example, Sunday, I'm doing a presentation at a church, a local church here in Savannah, and I've already done AI to just sort of give me some ideas, some bullet points about what I might include, but I'm going to do all the writing. And so I guess my advice to people is use AI with caution and figure out how it can help you with your presentation, whether it's writing or speaking, but don't rely on it for factual information unless you verify it somewhere else. When I left the business, we used to say we had to have three sources, verify with three sources. I don't know that everybody is doing that now, but it was very important for us to verify our information.
We're using it as well on the public relations, public relations side of things. We will take something after it's written and maybe drop it in there, and it catches spelling, and it may rewrite a sentence and make it a little bit better. So we're kind of trying to play with it, experiment with it a little bit as a tool, just seeing how,
I
we
think
can.
that's a good word. It's a tool. It's not the final thing. It is a tool. Yeah.
Right. You cannot rely on it. Please listen to that 100% in terms of accuracy, as you mentioned. So that's interesting. The other thing I want to talk about are deep fakes. Now, this is something that really kind of scares me, what I'm seeing with this new deep fake technology. I don't know if you've seen some of that, but it can actually mimic how a person looks and sounds. And I have a feeling it's going to impact the way news organizations gather and disseminate news. Do you see that as being a real game changer in terms of how we are going to actually be able to, develop a news product that people can trust and believe in?
I hope not. I have seen it. I mostly see it on social media. I'm not really seeing it with traditional media, unless it's the traditional media that I'm not watching. Because there are some media platforms that are of a political persuasion that I don't trust anyway. And so I certainly wouldn't expect that to trust them with the deep fake platform. So I'm not trusting it, and I think a lot needs to happen before we, just like with AI, but more, probably more so with deepfake. I think the biggest impact is the threat to jobs.
Yes.
If it gets to a point where it can be trusted or almost trusted all the time, it means that people like us are no longer going to have jobs.
Yeah. And I think, well noted. I know I have somebody I'm working with right now who's like been working in the AI space for 30 years and goes way back in it. And I asked him, what does he think, you know, is going to happen? He said, and he started by saying, well, like in the next 5 years. And then he said, really, I think three. You know, that window got shorter and shorter.
Well, it's definitely accelerating.
Yeah, he said, I think we're going to see massive layoffs, massive. He said, and I don't think people are prepared for that. And if we don't learn how to utilize AI as a tool and, you know, use it to speed up what we already do, then, yeah, like you said, people are going to be out of work.
Oh, absolutely. People are out of work anyway. I mean, I see in my social media and email at least every week another news organization is laying off people. Another news organization is cutting back because they have technology doing something. You know, things like even selling advertising. It's right. Not just the news. Even things like human resources. They're replacing bots and things yeah. like that with people who do those jobs, who hire the people like us. And mm-hmm. then they're being screened by bots. Therefore, if you or I had a fake resume, and we had all the right things on it, but it was fake. That's starting to happen now. We're seeing people who are getting jobs who don't have the credentials that they say they have, but the bots yeah. are screening it, you know? So unless, if I said that I had a PhD from Columbia University, unless they go to Columbia University, the bot is able to go to Columbia University and I don't, and verify that, then I could get the job. Mm. Someone could get the job without the credentials. So that's, it can affect the media in ways that we haven't even thought about.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a whole different ball game when it comes to leveling the playing field with how quickly that information also can be just spat out. You know, when you right. think about like, I know my husband was playing with it, and he was like, he said, I'm going to see if I can write a news release or something with this, right? And so it kicked it out in like, I don't know, a couple of seconds. And he goes, what do you think of this? And it was actually pretty good. He goes, yeah, it almost looks like you wrote it. I was like, oh, so, but it let me know that
it can be done. It can be done.
I'm like, wow. So, I mean, it's something that we must pay attention to. But if you think about it, the bottom line is AI gets its information from us. So yeah. that's where the source emanates from. And if we can continue to have, you know, creative ideas, it's the concern is maybe where it reaches a level of human consciousness.
Right.
Will it ever? It's like a baby. The more it learns, the more smart it gets. Just
so when you say human consciousness, you mean it'll think like we think, it'll take it from our minds and put it out there. So if yeah. I think I have a PhD from Columbia, it may agree that I have a PhD from Columbia, even though I don't. That's scary. I can think right. it.
Right, right. It's going to be interesting. I tell you, it's going to be a crazy ride. Well, I know we're getting close on time. I definitely wanted to, before we go, talk to you a little bit about your memoir.
Yes.
You know, just... great, coming full circle. I would like to ask you, how did you or why did you decide to do a memoir at the time?
Well, you know, toward the end of my career, I really didn't want to. I didn't think I was worthy of a memoir. When people asked me if I was going to write stories, I said, nobody really cares about what I've done. I've just been a copy editor and an executive editor and an executive director. And, you know, and I started thinking, well, wait a minute, I've been an executive editor, and I've been a managing editor. I've been a senior editor at USA Today. I have been an executive director. But it was really after I left the newsroom, my last newsroom in Montgomery, and I came back to Savannah where I grew up as chair of the Department of Journalism and Mass Comm. And as chair, it was one of my roles was to have conversations with our seniors as they were about to graduate, to be sure that they had all their credits in order. And also to talk to them. I always love to have these career conversations. Well, what are you going to do when you graduate? Are you going to graduate school? Are you going to get a job? What kind of job do you want to do? Are you going to start your own business? And in having those conversations, they would ask me questions about my career because they knew I hadn't been in the academy all of my career. And I started telling them stories. They would ask me questions very similar to some of the questions you have asked me today. And that's when I realized that I probably do have stories. In fact, some of the students said, you ought to write these stories. And so that's where the book came from. So the coming full circle part of the title is really, I started in Savannah. I started actually on the campus of Savannah State in a summer class between my junior and senior year. Then I came back to Savannah and I was back on the Savannah State campus as chair of the department. And then the subtitle is From Jim Crow to Journalism. So I grew up in the Jim Crow era in Savannah. And it's a book that has basically four themes: history, journalism, leadership, and diversity, because those are sort of the four things that I've done. It's very much about my professional life, not so much my personal life. And yes, this is a picture of 22-year-old me on the copy desk at the Providence Evening Bulletin back in 1972.
Yeah, I love that picture.
And on the back of the book is a picture of the typewriter that's sitting on a bookshelf over there. It's the typewriter I learned to type on at home.
I remember those. Yeah, when I started at the TV station in Virginia, we were on typewriters and right. They switched over to the new star system. So that's something I was like, I tell my kids, you all don't know how lucky you are, because we used to have a little, I try to explain that little white strip that you should have stick in and or X everything out. And if you had too many X's, you had to start over. You know,
right. Like take the paper and start over. That's right.
Yep. Yeah. Well, I type 90 words per minute today, you know. Yeah. Thanks for the early days. But, you know, I also wanted to talk a little bit quickly about Black History Month, since you are one of the leading scholars on Carter G. Woodson. Mm-hmm. So obviously coming to you here from the great state of Florida, where there are some new education standards going mm-hmm. on, which require things like students learning how slaves develop skills, which in some instances, and I'm quoting, could be applied for their personal benefit. What do you think of that? And why do you think it's important to delve into history in the month of February when we talk about African-Americans and the African diaspora, including African-American history?
So, I have been a columnist at my local paper, the Savannah Morning News, and one of the quotes that I have a local artist pulled from one of my columns was, Black history is American history. He put it on a piece of art, and on the other side of this wall, that painting is on that. In my house, he gave me the painting. But it is American history, so it's important that everyone learn Black history because it's American history. I'm a member of ASALA, which is the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, which was founded by Dr. Woodson, who founded Black History Week when I was in school, in grade school and high school, which later became in the 70s Black History Month. And so it's a time for us to just focus on who were some of the people that led us through so many eras and were successful in so many eras. And ASALA, the organization, had its national conference in Jacksonville last September. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of conversation about, should we go to Florida? Because, you know, Florida does have these new policies about not teaching AP Black history? Or should we not go to Florida, or should we go in defiance of those things that are happening in Florida? And we did go to Florida. I went to Florida. I presented my book while I was at the conference. So I think it's very important for us to just not only celebrate and talk about Black history in February, that's the challenge, but to talk about it all year long. One of the events at the conference was a public reading in a park of banned books. It gathered several people, including Dr. Janetta Cole, who you and I know, she was president of Spelman College, actually during the years that I was on the board of trustees at Spelman. And so this month, as a project for our local Asala Black History, we held a banned books reading here in Savannah. And so it's important for us to think of projects and people that we can bring to the community to keep that dialogue going. Every December during the month of Dr. Woodson's birthday, we have a reading of a book called Carter Reads the Newspaper. We've been reading it to fifth graders at different local schools for the last 4 years. We started during COVID virtually. The last 2 years, we've gone into the school and we read the book, and then we have a conversation with the students about Black history and about Dr. Carter. And in many cases, the students have read up on Dr. Carter before we get there. So it's really important for us to keep this conversation going. We cannot let it stop. And it's also important, not just for people who are African-American, but also everybody needs to hear this message. And so.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. We're about out of time, but this has been a real pleasure just to hear so many great stories over your life and career. I am absolutely thrilled that you have taken the time to talk with me today.
Well, thank you very much. It has been a pleasure. I always am happy to talk about journalism, but especially about my career, and especially with a Spelman sister. So thank you.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Well, and for full transparency, I would like to mention that Wanda is part of the Bishop Stein & Associates Public Relations Speakers Bureau. So if you would like to book her to speak, you can certainly visit our website at www.bsaprinc.com. Again, that's bsaprinc.com, and go to the Speakers Bureau page to fill out the booking form. You can also give us a call at 615-681-6588. Again, 615-681-6588 for more information. Thanks so much, everyone, for joining us. We'll be back again in 2 weeks for more of The Celeste Stein Show. I'm your host, Dr. Celeste Stein. Thanks for tuning in.